research on happiness from both a Jewish and psychological perspective is to contrast the English word happy. Let's see if you guys could get it. Think of this prefix. Hapless, happenstance, haphazard. Okay, well, H-A-P. So anybody want to guess what the H-A-P prefix must mean?
As it happens.
As it happens, sort of like, exactly. It's sort of like by luck. So the idea is if you're lucky enough to have certain things happen in your life, you're going to be happy. What do you think the average American says? If you ask them, what would it take to be lucky enough to be happy? What single...
Money,
exactly. That's the typical American answer. In contrast, simcha, the Hebrew word for happiness, has a very different kind of meaning and comes from a totally different kind of concept. The best way I know to explain it is a quick double enigma. Here's the double enigma. Enigma one is for many years, last 25 years, I volunteered to be the psychologist at a weekend retreat for families of children with cancer, Camp Chai Lifeline, Camp Simcha. So about, I don't know, must have been about 15 years ago, I'm sitting on Shabbos afternoon with a group of parents from the whole range of the Jewish community, all of who have in common that they have a child who has cancer. And there was a chassid in the group, Satmar chassid, and he just says, at this point everybody's very comfortable with each other, and he just sighs, he says, you know, this last Rosh Hashanah, my son was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. 10 days later, on Yom Kippur, I was sitting down in shul, and a wave of happiness washed over me like I never experienced in my entire life. I was like, what's he talking about? Happiness 10 days after what's probably one of the most trying kind of trials and tribulations a person could have. And then the other question, which is very similar in terms of the enigma, is many of you have read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And you may remember a section there. There's a 20-year-old woman barely out of adolescence, literally in the last minute of her life. And he's the doctor, Dr. Frankl, in the typhus ward. And she's laying down, and in her last minute, calls him over and says, Dr. Frankl. She's looking up through the slats of the roof in the typhus ward. She says, you know something? She said, until I came to this awful place, I was a frivolous teenager. I never knew what really mattered in life. And now that I'm looking up at the beautiful blue sky and the beautiful clouds and at God's beautiful world, I'm happier than I ever was. And she dies. She closes her eyes and dies. Now, how do you explain it? That's simcha. Simcha, what the research shows, is the following. Should I ramble on like this?
Please.
I'll get to this. Okay.
So, ramble away.
I'll ramble away. So here's what the research shows. The research shows that the money-happiness connection, I'll answer the double enigma in a minute in describing simcha. So here's what the research shows, is money doesn't hurt, right? You know, when you look at all the research on the connection between money and happiness, you find that once your basic needs are met, all the studies show, you pretty much are as likely to be happy. Once the most recent number was, I think, $70,000. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it might, in parts of the country, it might meet your basic needs. Once your basic needs are met, let's say you're driving down Broadway, okay? And in one lane, you have a guy on a bus on his way to his construction job downtown. Does Broadway go up or down? I'm not a Manhattanite.
Both ways.
Both are good. Okay, good. So I'm not making myself look like a hick here. So you're on your way. You're on your way to your construction job, and you have your lunch pail, and you're literally a blue collar guy. And the next car on the next lane is a limousine with somebody on his or her way to their job in some incredibly high paying financial sector job where they're making tens of millions of dollars just in bonuses. And let's say you try to predict the happiness of those two people, you wouldn't be able to based on what I just told you. It's impossible to predict the happiness. Rich guy might be very happy. Working class guy might be very happy. You can't tell. because there's no connection between money and happiness. And if I could illustrate that with a quick story, here goes. I just love this story. Michael Frank. Michael Frank is the guy, well-known economist, and he is a pretty wealthy guy today. And he talks about what happened when he got out of college and he volunteered for the Peace Corps. His plane lands, and a van picks him up, takes him on a 12-hour drive to the middle of Nepal, a dirt-poor part of Nepal, where he's going to spend the next 2 years teaching. It's for idealistic people, the Peace Corps. Okay? So they drop him off, and they say, okay, we'll pick you up in 2 years. And the first thing that hits him, he's going to live for the next 2 years in a one-room hut with no running water and no electricity. And he says to himself, I can't do it. Comes from a comfortable background. But then he says, you know something? It actually was amazing because everybody around me also was living in a one-room hut without water and electricity. He said, I was amazed at how quickly I got used to it. But here's where it gets interesting. He gets his first paycheck. His first paycheck, he realized he's going to be making $20 a month. $20 a month. And now he says, $30 a month. $30 a month.
All right. Okay?
In my community, I live in Great Neck where I have my practice. If you give a kid $30 a week for allowance, they'll call the Child Protective Services. They'll call you for child abuse. So he's getting $30 a month, and he says, forget it, I'm going home. But then he very quickly discovers nobody in that area of Nepal is making more than $20 a month. And he goes on to say that he never felt wealthier or happier in his life living in Nepal on $30 a month in a one-room hut with no running water and electricity. It's all relative. It's all relative. You know, in this week's Torah reading, we talk about Bakol, the idea of feeling that you have everything. And has nothing, it's all subjective. It's your decision, and that ties, and then I'll be quiet. Mm-hmm. That ties to the answer of simcha. Simcha, the Hebrew word simcha, a colleague once suggested, comes from the conjunction of the two words, shem moach. It's where your head is at. All the research shows the key to happiness is family, friends, and faith, not funds. When I ask high school kids, what's the three F's? They usually get family and friends. None of them get faith. The girls always say food, and the boys smile. Okay? And so this is about sex, right? I'm allowed to do it.
Yeah, like,
I'm
need a reference.
I'm easing my way. Okay. So what does that mean? It means that the Jewish concept of happiness is being connected to meaning and purpose. Or as the Chazon Ish, a great rabbi from the late 1800s and not until he died in the early 1950s, he said, for he who knows the light of truth, there is no sadness in the world. Okay? What's the answer to the double enigma? And then I'm really finishing. The answer to the double enigma is that Chassid, 10 days after his son's ominous diagnosis of leukemia, he was surrounded by meaning. He was surrounded in Shul on Yom Kippur by connection to family, friends, and faith. And that young woman, with an all-too-short life, experiencing a connection to something greater and bigger than herself, in that last minute, she was shamoah, connected not to money, not to the ephemeral, but to real, lasting meaning and truth.
Wow, thank you. Yeah. So can I ask you a follow-up question on that?
Sure.
So if that's...
I make up all the answers.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
You know, if those are the contributing factors to happiness, then can you give us, and this is probably difficult to answer for everybody and to make a, you know, paint this in such a broad way, but why do you think our generation suffers so much from, or is struggling so much with being happy?
Yeah, so it's a complicated question because... you know, Martin Seligman, the founder of positive psychology, professor at Penn, he says the self is a very poor place to find meaning. Meaning is found, again, outside, with chesed, with doing good for others. I'll tell you the affluenza studies. I hope nobody here is from Scarsdale, are you? No Scarsdale people? Nobody who moved from Scarsdale? Maybe, you know, I'll make a great neck to be safe, okay? There's, up at Columbia, there's a psychologist in the clinical psych department, and her name is Dr. Sonia Luther. And she did studies that are now called affluenza studies. She compared affluent kids in that Westchester community, suburb, and she compared them in a variety of ways to kids who lived on the other side of the tracks in areas where there wasn't much money. And she was expecting to find tremendous privilege and, you know, not too many problems in the rich kids. Money should be able to buy mental health and, you know, good psychological adjustment. And what she was shocked to find was that the affluent kids had triple the rate of depression, triple the rate of anxiety, and a higher rate of alcohol and drug abuse. So then she did a series of studies to deconstruct what's behind the affluenza. And her answer, I think, is responsive to your question, as I understand it. She found three active ingredients in affluenza. Ingredient one was it was never easy to be unique. You had to. It was never enough to be. You couldn't be average. Like, people don't go to shul in Scarsdale and brag that, oh, my kid, she got 50th percentile on the SATs. Or my son or my daughter, MCAT, right down the middle, 50th percentile. There needs to be excellence to shine in that kind of background, okay? And that's tough. It's hard to develop your uniqueness. To really be happy, you have to be connected to your unique spark, the uniqueness of who you are, you know? And to be internal. Rav Kook, a great rabbi of the last generation, he said, Yesh ben chorin sherucho ruach shalevet. There are free people, free with an F, who have the spirit of a slave. V'yesh eved sherucho mleya cheros. And there are slaves filled with freedom. Listen to what he says. Hang this on your refrigerators, okay? Haneman la'atzmi yuso ben chorin hu. If you're faithful to your inner essence and the essence of who you are, you're always going to be free. Umi shekol chayav rak b'mashato v'yofe b'enei acherim. Somebody whose entire life is only about what is good in the eyes of others. Like, what's it's called impression management. What will others think? Whoever. That person will always be a slave and will have the unhappiness of a slave. So that's number one, is uniqueness. The second thing Dr. Luther found when she deconstructed the affluenza studies was required helpfulness, part of the themes of the recent Torah readings, meaning that the adolescents in that Westchester suburb, they didn't necessarily give back. Sure, they did service learning to get into a good college, but it doesn't count if you're doing it to get into a good college. The kids on the other side of the tracks, they took care of each other. They had the happiness that comes from mutual giving. I'm sure you know, or maybe not, there's no reason why you have to know this, but the Hebrew word natan, to give, is a palindrome.
Right.
When you give, you get back. Natan is a palindrome, okay? And that's the key to happiness. So it was required helpfulness in the poor kids, was literally the key to happiness. And the third was time. Parents were often very preoccupied. They outsourced their parenting. And there's a direct connection between being present. As I'm talking to all of you, and I'm making eye contact with you guys, and I'm moving my hands like an old Jewish man that I am, okay? So if you had a picture of the motor cortex of my brain, you'd see dedicated motor neurons in the motor cortex of my brain. But here's what recent research showed. Is all of you are looking at me, making eye contact with me, which you're a great audience, right? You're all making eye contact, and I imagine even the people in Facebook world, okay? Hi, everybody. Even in Facebook world, okay? I'm an old man, you can tell that. As you make eye contact with me, the research shows in the last decade, there's something called mirror neurons. And guess what's happening? The motor cortex of your brain is going like this. Because we're hardwired for empathy. But you need attention. You need focus. You can't be looking down. You can't be preoccupied with the continuous partial attention of our smartphones. And that is something that has not been so easy, and that's my long-winded answer to your question.
Wow, thank you. All right, I'm going to switch gears a little. By the way, we're going to give you guys a chance, even on Facebook, to ask some questions as well.
And tell me if I'm going too long.
Not at all. These are great.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. I told you.
Can I give you a little?
Huh?
Please.
So, I just say something about this?
Please.
I was once, I'm friendly with this famous rabbi guy. His name is Rabbi Matzio Solomon. He's like one of the leading rabbis of our time. Incredibly wise man. And I once had to be in his living room dealing with some child abuse cases in his community. And it was like 2 weeks before Purim. And he, so he had out a very fine bottle of wine. And he asked me, he always thought, why is it there's a special blessing that you make on really good wine? Okay, I don't know if this fits. Yeah, looks like a nice Chardonnay, okay? So there's a special blessing you make, it's Atova Neitiv, which is weird because it's usually a blessing that's somehow saved for like really significant events in our life. And why make such a big deal out of good wine? There's a lot of good things. We don't make special blessings when we get our new Lexus or whatever, you know, or, you know, we get the apartment of our dreams. He says because of the lesson, the hidden lesson in wine. He says, what's the story of wine? You take grapes, you basically grind the grapes down. It becomes this ugly-looking product that is crushed. It's crushed and looking like, almost like metaphorically, like there's no hope. Look at it. Look what wine is. And he says, and look at this sublime drink that comes out of it. And it's sort of like a way of recognizing that at the other end of some very tough times in life, there's the beauty of what this could bring us. But anyway, I'm sorry.
Beautiful. Chaim. Chaim. That's a beautiful teaching. Now to get a little more negative. Anger. Can you give us a little of Jewish perspective, psychological Jewish perspective on anger management? Because everybody's trying to manage some level of anger, I would imagine, whether it's at home or work. And is there any way for us we could learn from you how to express our anger in some kind of constructive way without hurting others?
Yeah. So I'll do this in a somewhat shorter way than my expansive discussion until now, because I know our next topic hopefully is one that is a happier topic. So anger, and I'll just the short thing is first of all three words. There's a book written, Jewish book written in the 1200s, 12 to 1300s, called Sefer Chassidim. Now, sometimes Hebrew captures tremendous wisdom in three words. Listen to these three words going back to the 13th century. Here's what it says. Achris ketata charata. Think of that. Achris ketata charata. You know what that means? After argument, there's regret. After argument, there's regret. And think about it. I've been married for almost 40 years now, thank God, okay? And by the way, what we were hearing before in the parsha, it's really true. The love only grows when you have a marriage blessed with mutual giving. It's an unbelievable gift because it's mutual giving and grows to make it much much more exponentially. But it takes time to develop. It didn't start that way. But anyway, Achris Ketata Charata is basically the idea that we always feel bad when we lose our cool. Think about the last time you lost it, okay? Almost everybody says, the last time you lost your temper, even if you were 100% right, don't you feel a little bad about it? Isn't there that kind of regret? Don't you wish you could undo it? There's a lot of research showing that. Three P's, to keep it very simple. The three P's on anger control are pullback, meaning the pullback response. Okay, that's the first P. Then the second P is perspective taking, and the third P is planned discussion. So let me tell you what I mean by it. Pull back. and here is, I'm going to quote Viktor Frankl again. Pullback is, there's separate neurologic circuitry for rage. When you give into your anger in an animalistic way right away, it's the short circuitry to our amygdala, to our primitive brain. Interestingly, it's sort of like behind the nose. That's why the Hebrew word for anger is af, the word for nose. Af and af. It's anger, and it's the short circuitry. Okay? Then there's the longer circuitry that goes up to our frontal prefrontal cortex, where some men here put their tefillin on every morning. We obsess over exactly where we put those things on, because we're literally trying to get them over the part of our head where perspective taking lives, where the human part of us lives, where the non-animalistic part of us lives. So that's the second P, is perspective taking, and the third P is planned discussion. First, on the first P, on pullback. The key is to pull back. The key is just, if you could just do what your mothers might have taught you. Take a slow breath off, right? Normal breath in, slow breath out, count to 10 slowly, and remember that that's the key. But here's the beauty of Viktor Frankl, the same guy I quoted before, the concentration camp survivor who founded logotherapy. Again, if you haven't read Man's Search for Meaning, try to read it. It's worth reading. Here's what he wrote, and it's the key to anger control, I think. He said, between stimulus and response, there's this space. In that space lies our choice. In that space lies our growth. And that's the key. Stimulus, somebody does something to get us upset. I did something terrible when I parked on the when I parked on 85th Street today. You know, I found a spot that was good at 7, and I accidentally hit into the guy in front of me. And he got out of his car. He was furious, and I don't blame him. I don't blame him.
Furious. I was shocked.
Was it you? Because it could have been. I was worried he was going to be here. But you know what? I apologized right afterwards, and I was happy to pay for any. I don't think I did any damage or whatever, but I saw him calm down. Between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space lies our growth. So my space was not to get defensive, because it was clearly my fault. And I had to make good on whatever damage I might have done. I didn't. It was really, I just kissed his car, I promise. Okay? Should I show you pictures? And his space was very admirably, he immediately calmed down when I apologized. You know, he immediately calmed down. You know, and that's the key. Okay? Pull back, space, and then perspective taking.
Was it the apology that you believe helped him come down?
Yeah. I think, because had I been defensive, he would have been rightfully furious at me, and I wasn't being manipulative. I really felt badly. You know, you have to make amends.
So the apology can diffuse, because he would have gone that way.
Yeah, but a right apology. I think you had a session on apology here. Right. So important, because you could see careers go. You know, so important. I won't get political. But the ability to apologize is so incredibly important. You know, the ability to say, "Chatasi l'Hashem, I made a mistake," and to know how to apologize and to not be defensive, it's a gift to be able to do it, and it's a skill that we could build. Now, on the perspective taking, if I could just say a quick vignette on perspective taking, the power of perspective taking. That's the second P. I'm choosing between about 6 different stories, but I'll take this one. A young woman in our neighborhood died, and she left a number of young children. She was a community leader. She was very beloved. She left a totally shattered young widower, and there was a massive funeral, well over 1,000 people, in a community not meant, on a street in the suburban area, in a shul, not meant for such crowds. So after this horribly upsetting funeral, I go outside and my car is parked. I did not bump into a bumper. My car is parked on the street there. And there's a massive traffic jam. Massive. And there's a tow truck driver, this huge guy, who's sitting in his tow truck, blowing his horn. His face is turning red. He's going nuts. Because all he sees is a bunch of Jews who are just talking. He doesn't know what just happened. And he's ready to kill. And I see him getting redder and redder with his fury. And he takes a crowbar. It's like he's going to... And he looks at me and says, what the expletive deleted is going on here? So I told him, I said, look, I figure I have nothing to lose. I said, you won't believe it. I said, there's a horrible tragedy. And I said, it was a young woman who died. She left a number of young children. The community is devastated. People are so worried about her husband. We're worried about her kids. The community needed her. Her children certainly need her. Her husband needed her. You're seeing a devastated community. As I'm explaining this, you literally see the color of his face go from red to normal color. Within 5 minutes, he was at the head of the road directing traffic. That's the power of perspective taking. That's the second P. And think about it for yourself. If when you're angry at somebody, you could get curious. Get curious. When you get curious, it lights up frontal prefrontal cortex. What could they be thinking? What could this guy be thinking when he smashed into my car? I didn't smash. I really didn't. When he gently kissed my car with his bumper, okay? What was he thinking? What was he thinking? And me getting curious, like, what? To the extent that you could get curious about the person who's infuriated you, it's right away going to lead to a more calm response. And the third P, which is for a different talk, is planned discussion. To be understood, first understand. When you're calm, to be able to sit down and talk. Now, not everybody is willing to do that. That's a fascinating talk. What happens if people aren't willing to make peace? What happens if they don't have any interest in dialogue? And how do you deal with people who have no interest in dialogue? That's not for now, but that's a whole fascinating area with incredible Jewish wisdom on that, on the growth that comes from not necessarily engaging, the growth that comes from sort of like working on yourself. When you have no control over the other side, work on yourself. You just work on yourself.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Tell us a little about gratitude.
Thanksgiving is coming.
This is the week we're supposed to feel grateful and thankful. Tell us a little about what the recent psychological research tells us and how we can somehow grow from this ourselves here.
Fine, good, okay. So I'm a rabbi's son, so I get very nervous about running over with my time. So my father would run over in his speeches when I was a kid. People would like come to me and say, can you get him to finish it? And he's a great speaker. But anyway, so I have this rabbi's son syndrome.
Right.
Anyway, so but I'll tell you a little bit about gratitude. Last weekend, I was in Chicago. I was a scholar in residence in that community. And I said something that a number of people who were at the speech I gave Friday night came over to me at my other speeches the next day, and they told me they tried it and it worked. And one woman said, this is my first good night of sleep in years. So try this. Let me tell you what I mean. Gratitude is a fundamental Jewish value. The very word to be Jewish, Yehudi, comes from the word gratitude, right? Hapamodes Hashem. Leah was supposed to, by rights, only have 3 children. When she had her 4th children's name was Judah, Yehuda, which means to be grateful. She's saying, I'm grateful because I got more than my fair share. Now, there's more to it than just that story. It's basically to be... Gratitude is at the core of... In many systems of Jewish thought, it's at the core of a value that we have to nourish and nurture. When you do, the psychological research shows your happiness levels go up. You are more likely to be kind. People are more likely to do things. So you ever have somebody who you helped out and you really did good stuff for them, and even though you did good stuff for them, they weren't grateful. Are you ever going to be nice to that person again? Of course not. It's just smart to be grateful. Not in a manipulative way, but the problem with gratitude is that it is extremely difficult to keep it going. Habituation takes over. Here's what the research shows. We're much more likely to be grateful to somebody if we're driving on the New Jersey Turnpike and we get a flat tire and a total stranger helps us change our flat. We're much more likely to be grateful to that individual than we are to our own mothers, fathers, friends, children, whatever it is. Okay? we're least likely to be grateful to the people who we owe the most to, because there's habituation. We get used to it. We don't even notice it. I was once in Hawaii. There was a paper that had to be given at a child psychiatry conference. And on our research team, I volunteered to go. Okay, so I had an expense paid trip to this unbelievable hotel in Hawaii. And I cut a session. And I'm sitting outside watching the unbelievable, it was a moonbow. The moon was so bright. You saw a rainbow over the moon. It was a waterfall. It was unbelievable beauty. And I'm sitting there. And I had to share. You have to share what you're grateful for. There was nobody there. Everybody was in the session. I was the only misbehaving psychologist in the conference. And I turned to the only guy who was there, a hotel worker. I said, sir, I can't imagine how lucky you are to live, to work in a place with such indescribable beauty. He sort of came out of his trance. He said, what? He said, sir, I don't see what you're seeing. He said, I dread coming to work Monday morning as much as the next guy. And boy, was that a wake-up call to me. Now, if I don't give them the way to sleep better, they're going to be very angry at me, so I'm going to take the time to do it. There are a number of ways to bring gratitude into your life. How do you overcome habituation? Okay? By the way, you habituate to anything. And boy, I have such good stories on this, but I'm going to control myself, okay? But let me share with you a couple of things. First of all, two practical ways of overcoming habituation, because without it, it's very hard, because otherwise, what in Hebrew is called hergel, habituation takes over, okay? You know, the most amazing, amazing things. You could be living in Trump Tower, and you're not going to see the beauty of the luxury you're living in, okay? First of all, one simple recommendation. We know that if you develop gratitude in your life, your health improves for a variety of ways. But one of the things that positive psychologists do is they find that if you discipline yourself to, before you fall asleep, to have pre-sleep cognitions about, let's say, three things in your life that you're grateful for. And you develop a script in your head, or three things in the day you're grateful for. Sort of count your blessings. I think about wonderful times with, you know, wonderful family vacations or incredible times with my grandchildren. And you know what happens if you do that? If you do that, three things will happen to your sleep. You'll fall asleep more quickly. You'll sleep more deeply. And you'll feel more rested the next day. Just from disciplining yourself to think about that core Jewish value of things that you're grateful for. So you get a sort of like a toolbox in your head of, you know, what do I have to be grateful for? I'm so proud of my daughter. I have a daughter. Two of my kids are therapists, okay? And I just heard from my daughter that, and it was so beautiful. I was really proud. I should tell her if she ever listens to this. What she does every Saturday night when they make the Havdalah service, right at the end of Shabbos, you know, the beautiful service of lighting the candle and smelling the, you know, that whole Havdalah deal. She goes around to my four grandchildren and my son-in-law, and she has them each share one thing from the previous week that they're grateful for. One thing. And she says it's transformative. It's transformative. And by making it into that ritual, now people do it at different times. Some people, when they light the Friday night candles, they think of something they're grateful for. Or when they have the Friday night meal, they go around the table, even with guests, and say one thing from the week you're grateful for. The research shows when you do that in a systematic way, your happiness levels shoot up for a little while. Because you're cueing in to something fundamental.
And that prevents the habituation. That prevents us from taking for granted, you know, or just sort of mulling over, because we've seen that sunset every day.
Exactly. Because it has you think of it in a different kind of way. And if I could share with you, am I? I'm okay.
You're great.
Okay, so
Let me share.
Let me share with you.
I know I'm annoying.
Let me share with you. And I know at least have. I think of whatever. Okay. Good. So here's. Let me share with you. Can I share with you an amazing story?
Please.
And maybe this is a way to sort of pull together some of this. Two stories, okay? Here's story number one. My main area in the secular world is post-traumatic stress disorder. So I've been very involved in research and trauma, you know, and on a team involved in whatever. I do that stuff. I find it to be incredibly gratifying work. And because of that, I have some of my best stories come. I was in Sri Lanka after the tsunami. I go to Israel sometimes after terrible terror bombings. But one of the most interesting things I got invited to over the last number of years is Frankfurt, Germany. Companies that benefited from slave labor by German law have to pay to have a conference every few years for the remaining survivors in Europe of the Holocaust. So, and their therapists, most of whom were Russian, they had no Jewish education whatsoever. Hitler robbed them of the right of a Jewish education. So the first time I was invited, by the way, everything you say in that conference, everybody's wearing headsets, and it's translated into three languages, German, French, and German, French, and Russian. And what's very interesting is two-thirds of the audience laughed at all my jokes almost immediately. One group, you could guess which group it was, usually laughed at my jokes about 5 minutes later. Okay? Now, you could get, I don't want to say anything that would be seen as negative, but so the first time I went, they had asked me, they said, does Judaism have anything to offer to our understanding of trauma? So until then, they hadn't had people, they had psychologists, but not psychologists who integrated Jewish stuff with psychological stuff. So they said, it's an experiment, we don't know if it'll work. So I give the first talk. The first talk was about the brilliant insights of Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch, who was a brilliant, brilliant rabbi in Frankfurt in the late 1800s. And so I gave a talk about the brilliant insights into how to deal with the tough times in life. For example, one of his brilliant statements is when you say, Kaylee, Kaylee, lama azavtani, and tell him it says, God, why do you abandon me? So it's a Hebrew word, you don't read it lama. You don't ask why. When something bad happens to you, and you're in a traumatic event, don't ask why. He says, you're reading the vowelization is wrong. The Hebrew, lamed mem hey. Pronounce that lama. You go from why to what? Lama azavtani, for what purpose? How do I get meaning out of my suffering? So I did this thing and at my first talk, and it's being translated by the men behind and women behind the glass booths who are translating. And a line of people line up to ask me questions afterwards. And I have the headphones on because it's being translated into English. And the first woman comes up, and she starts, her therapist is at her side. For the first time in 70 years, she starts speaking in Yiddish. She hadn't thought in Yiddish or spoken a word of Yiddish in 70 years, the day that Mengele chose her six siblings to go to their death in the gas chambers and sadistically chose for her to live. From that point, she shut off any connection to anything Jewish. She hadn't thought in Yiddish. She just shut herself off. And she never talked about that horrible day when her entire family was wiped out. And she gets up, and in Yiddish, she starts talking, and she tells the story of that day, crying hysterically. And she's saying it in Yiddish. And her therapist doesn't understand Yiddish. I understood enough to know what she was talking about. And she was asking me, why? And she suddenly opened up and started sharing that. And I was blown away. And I found out later from her therapist is that something about the connection between her Jewish roots that she had totally shut off and the wisdom, the ancient wisdom, maybe integrated with some of the psychology, somehow opened her up. But here's where it becomes a gratitude story. 40 people or so were waiting behind her. And every one of them had the same message for me. Every one of them, they said, David, do you know how lucky you are? Do you know what a gift it is to have had the freedom of having an education about your identity, about your roots? They said, do you know what a gift it is? And I never knew until then. I never recognized it. And I went back home the next week, and for the first time in my life, I was tuned in to something that was, my father calls it the ordeal of the ordinary. Our challenge is that sometimes the ordinary challenges us because we don't see, to us it's ordinary. To them, it was extraordinary. And to be able to develop the muscle of understanding and appreciate the gifts that we can have if we choose to exercise them is unbelievable.
Wow, thank you. Thank you so much.
I'll tell you the second story later, don't worry.
I want to give you guys, first of all, thank you. We're not done. I just want to give you guys here an opportunity, or anyone on Facebook, if they... just to ask any questions, open it up to you, please.
So you talked about anger. What about disrespect? Because that seems to destroy a lot of things. People at work slight you between family members, and it lingers for years.
Yeah.
And even small disrespect. I didn't get invited to this meeting, or I didn't get the right position in the wedding.
Yeah.
And a decade later, it still matters.
Yeah. It's a cynicism, right? It's like when somebody just doesn't give you the right kind of. The right kind of recognition for what you feel you deserve or whatever.
Can I just ask you to
repeat the question? Yeah. The question was, what about, we talked about anger, but what about disrespect? What about somebody who slights you, doesn't give you, what you deserve in terms of recognition of your abilities, or somehow they don't recognize your uniqueness. Is that right, more or
yes.
less? Yeah. So a couple of thoughts about that. If you could calmly strike when the iron is cold, if you could calmly talk to them when they're calm, and just sort of say, "Look, you probably don't understand, but it's really important to me that you value my opinion." Whatever it is that you say, but only do it not in the heat of the moment. Strike when the iron is cold. You have a planned discussion with them. You sit down with them. And you talk to them, and you explain to them. Now they may not listen. If they don't listen, because a lot of people won't care, they'll get defensive, and they won't be responsive, there's something called the tyranny of the shoulds. Tyranny of the shoulds is, it could become a tyrant if you allow that to control your life, saying, it shouldn't be this way, it should be this way, it should be that way. No, not necessarily. Very often life is not fair. Very often people don't treat us the way we should be treated. But we don't want to let that, to quote Hanan Harchol, who has a brilliant video series on this, he says, don't allow them to live rent-free in your brain. Okay? Don't let them take up real estate in your brain. It's not worth it. If you Google, don't do it now, except the Facebook people, if you Google the word Harchol, that's his last name, Harchol, and forgiveness, the first hit, I think, will be brilliant. He has these little videos of animated conversations he had with his father. And one on forgiveness develops this in a beautiful way. So that's the key. If you don't have connection over it, if you don't have control over something, you always have control over your reaction. Does that kind of make sense? Great, thanks.
I was just going to add, if it's okay, we often, we try to avoid confrontation, usually at all costs. But one of the most important verses in the Torah that speaks to this issue, the Torah tells us that hochech tochech et amitecha, that we're supposed to actually reprove our neighbor. A lot of people see that as one of the sources for the kind of work MGE does, to go out and try to improve our Jewish brothers and sisters' relationship with God. The Ramban, the great Nachmanides, said that it's referring to an altogether different situation. He said that it's referring to a situation where you get offended. And when someone insults you or doesn't give you the respect you feel you deserve, he says, hochech tochech et amitecha, you should get it off your chest, you should say something, v'lo tisa alav chet, so that you don't bear sin because of the other person. And he asks, what sin? And if you look at the very beginning of that same verse, the verse opens with the phrase, lo tisna tachicha bilvavecha, do not harbor hate for your fellow Jew. We're not technically supposed to hate a fellow Jew, which is not simple to do, but how do you prevent yourself from coming to hate someone who's offended you? the Ramban Nachmanides answers by hocheach tocheach, by saying something. Now, as Dr. Pelkovitz, as you're saying, it's not so simple. How do you say it? Obviously, you don't do this in front of other people. Take the person aside privately. But often we sweep it under the rug. We often speak when probably we should keep quiet. And when we should say something, we're always afraid to make a mountain out of a molehill, whatever the expression is. But what ends up happening is that it festers, it builds. And the Jewish recipe, I've always been taught, is to really say something so that you can also give the chance to that person to apologize. Or even if they don't, you've at least gotten something. You know, you talk about the real estate, you at least prevent, some of that negative energy from taking up space in your mind and your heart.
I have a question from Facebook. Do you have any advice for how to deal with continual intense stress while experiencing PTSD?
Sure. If you're having, full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder and you have continuing ongoing stress, there are a number of our ability to treat that in the field of psychiatry, psychology, social work, other mental health disciplines has become really very much improved. And there are a number of really very powerful evidence-based treatments. It might be a combination of cognitive techniques, ways of thinking about differently, learning how to calm yourself down physiologically. Mindfulness is often extremely helpful. And then there's the behavioral channel to avoid avoidance, and maybe even a place for medication. But the bottom line is there's no reason to have to suffer with full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder. There's excellent treatments out there. And if this question is coming from the New York City area, this has become one of the capitals of the world for very effective treatments. So I'm happy to give information on that, in terms of how to find an effective referral. Okay.
Yeah, in the back.
First of all, I work with your daughter, by the way, so regardless.
Oh, good. Okay. Thanks.
She is great, by the way. Thank you. Yeah. I'm totally, totally objective.
Yeah,
she's also amazing, right?
This is less direct, but could you talk a little bit about gratitude within relationships and appreciation? I feel like a lot of the time I hear from friends or colleagues that they feel underappreciated, or people, they always say, I feel like this person doesn't appreciate me. So maybe why do you think that is, or how can you show appreciation to others?
Right, yeah. Excellent. So I'll repeat the question, right? So the question is an excellent question. What do you expect from a friend of my daughter, right? So, my daughter. So I have three daughters, by the way. I'll talk about it anyway. And a son. So the question is, very often in relationships, it could be a couple where there's a feeling that there isn't enough appreciation of one another. And that becomes a source of conflict, a source of disagreement, a source of ongoing tension. Now, the reason for it is, look, when you're head over heels in love in the early stage of a relationship, in the romantic stage of a relationship, it's clear that you're going to be able to, there it's not hard to appreciate each other. And there it's that much of a challenge because you're in that early stage. The hard thing is habituation, the equivalent of the Hawaii story I said, because you just get used to it. And it's a challenge in general. It's the nature of relationships. It's just very hard to discipline ourselves to continue to show appreciation. The only way I know to do it is to ritualize it. You have to, and that's not fake. When I say ritualize it, I mean is you build in into the fabric of your lives. It would mean Dr. John Mordechai Gottman, one of the giants of marital therapy, who's in Seattle. He has people, when he does marital therapy, he has husbands and wives. He'll have a husband deliberately spend, 3, 4, 5 minutes before you go home, thinking of all the ways that your partner has helped you. That was nurture the fondness and admiration. You know, when you do that, it may seem a little fake, but the psychological space in your head gets filled with that. And you know what? Your love and appreciation will grow. You nourish that. You force yourself to think about it. And it doesn't mean that you don't have the right to be annoyed at each other. It doesn't mean you don't have the right to want to kill each other. But you also have to build on, remind yourself what you fell in love with. And when you do that, but it should be in a ritualized way. You tie it to something. When you're going home from work, you tie it, and if it's not a daily thing, at least 3, 4 times a week. And then you discipline yourself also to share it. If it becomes something, I remember when I was growing up, my father would, in a very real way, often compliment my mother in some very deliberate kind of way. You know, and he'd say, "Wow, that's unbelievable what you did." You know, and it wasn't fake, and she would do it to him. It was just part of the oxygen that we breathed in our home. And when you do that, it could become a habit. Just one quick thing. If you're comfortable doing this, if this half of the room could take, imagine if you had a pencil, or you, and put it in your mouth like this. Okay, fine. This half of the room, take a pencil or some object, put it in your mouth like this. Right? This side is like this. This side is like this. Now you can do it. It may be uncomfortable, okay? This side of the room, any joke I would tell you, you would laugh more. This side of the room, any joke I would tell you, you would laugh less. Why? As our rabbis tell us, achar ha-pa'ulos nimshach al-vavos. Our heart is drawn to actions. When you do it like this, you force a smile. When you force a smile, you're going to find things to be funnier. When you force a frown by going like this, you're not going to find life to be as funny. Okay? Now, what's the take-home message? The take-home message is that you could somehow, in some ways, by nourishing and developing your fondness and admiration for each other, if you don't do it in a ritualistic way, it's not going to happen. But if you build it into the fabric of your life, and you overcome the discomfort, guys in particular have a hard time doing it, especially if they grew up in a home that didn't do it. But you know what? It could become a skill. It could become a skill. Yeah.
So if you don't mind, I just want to use that as a plug for Shabbat morning MGM services, because how do we begin our prayers each and every morning? Even during the weekday, we say these same prayers. We thank God for Malbish HaRimim, for giving us clothing. I don't know the last time we actually stopped and thought about the fact that we have clothing to wear in the morning. Or we say Pokeach Ivrim, that God opens our eyes and we can see. And Rezokeif Kufufim, that God straightens the bent. And these, actually, according to the Talmud, were supposed to be said corresponding to the activities. That when a Jew got up in the morning, put their feet on the floor, Rokar et alamayim, God allows us to step. And when we stretched, and when we could open our eyes, Pokeach Ivrim, we put on our clothing, Malbish HaRimim. It's such a powerful but simple way, I guess, of fighting, as you're saying, habituation.
Yeah.
Because if we could actually start the day feeling great that I can see, I have clothing to wear, I can stretch, I can walk, then it might help in perspective all the other issues and things we're contending with.
Yeah.
Question.
1 second before, we just want everyone to say hi to the people watching. Just wave and say hi.
We appreciate you. We want to express our gratitude to those of you on Facebook.
And everyone on this side.
Your questions for Facebook Live.
Yep. So type them in the comments and we'll work them in. And we won't use your names. You're welcome to be anonymous. Except everyone will see that you don't have them.
Okay. Yes, Alan.
What impact do you think the media has had on couples' perception of their own sexual satisfaction?
Okay, so the question is...
Yeah, you repeat that one.
Yeah. So the question is what impact has the media had on couples' perception of their own sexual satisfaction. So, really important question, because there's interesting. For example, even going back a number of years ago, they found that kids who were regular sitcom watchers had a different approach to sexuality than kids who weren't. More casual approach to sexuality in terms of engaging in sexual behavior that wasn't necessarily associated with more in-depth, enduring relationships. So I think the media, first of all, if you look at some of the dangers of what social media can do in terms of a lot of good, but also in terms of at times being likely to promote the myth of the instant soulmate, for example. Pornography really does have impact in a way that it could reinforce a view, a blunted view of sexuality and blunted expectations about the way people should look. And it really, clearly, there's a lot of research that shows that it has had impact, but it's fixable. I believe it's really fixable. When we go from threat to challenge, as we heard in the previous talk in this room about this week's Parsha, this week's Torah reading, when you see that what sexuality is really about, it's about connection, it's about the mutual giving, it's about the real I-thou relationship of connecting, you know, all the research shows that the level of sexual satisfaction in couples who are committed and truly love each other and have mutual giving and are, you know, literally have a lifetime of giving, much higher level of sexual satisfaction, and it keeps growing, as opposed to the passion that is kind of reinforced on media that is ephemeral, you know, and sometimes empty. Is that sounding too old manish and too preachy? Okay.
We're getting more to that next week with the sex therapist.
Yes, yeah. Well,
thank you.
Right.
Thank you.
If you could recommend one, like, what's one book that you think everybody has to read?
The one book on relationships that I think you have, which is, I have a book at home, which is, it's 3,000 mental health professionals got together and recommended the best self-help books in different areas. Okay? And the highest rated book on relationships is the book by John Mordechai Gottman, who I told, he's the guy, you might have read about him in Blink, he's the guy who gets a couple sitting in a room together, and in 7 minutes, he can tell with 94% accuracy if they'll be divorced in 5 years.
Wow.
And he has all these predictors, okay? And the predictors are things like harsh startup, criticism, contempt, having trouble with calming down. You know, you get angry and you just don't know how to chill yourself out. But he wrote a book. He's published more than 400 peer-reviewed articles. He happens to wear a big yarmulke. He's not an observant guy. He wears a big yarmulke out of respect to his father, mm-hmm. who is a rabbi and Holocaust survivor. So he wears a yarmulke wherever he goes. Brilliant, brilliant man. And he wrote a book called, The Seven. Can somebody take your iPhone out or your Android, your phone? I think it's called The Seven Ingredients of a Successful Marriage. John Mordechai Gottman, Gottman. That's the only 5-star book in my 3,000 mental health professional book. It is excellent. And it's grounded in
seven
really...
Seven
principles for a healthy relationship or something.
Yes.
Yeah. It's really, Gottman, it's really, that's, because it's grounded in really solid work. Really solid. I can tell you some great stories about him, but I won't.
The seven principles for making marriage work?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
Go for it. Why not? Yeah.
Please.
You also spoke about how, when we're focused on other people's perceptions of ourselves, we enslave ourselves. Can you speak a little bit about what research shows about
partners with different socioeconomical backgrounds, different levels of education, like just kind of clarifying like what things really do matter and what things don't really matter, or when they feel like they really matter, do they really, really matter?
Great question. Great question. Yeah. So to summarize the question, it's the question.
Who should you marry?
Right. That's the question. But it's an excellent question. The question is what predicts success in marriage, and what's silly? What doesn't matter?
And also,
maybe we just focus on that.
Yes. And what do you tell yourself when you know you've heard it all before that these things matter and those things don't, but you feel tied to the things that don't matter.
Right. Now, how do you detach from the superficial? Because the superficial is powerful. It's powerful, you know. Especially when you're talking about something as fundamental as ending loneliness by throwing yourself into a relationship that might not have much of a future. I hear. I'll give the basic answer as I understand it. A sociologist at Cornell a couple of years ago, this is one of many ways of answering this, he wrote a book based on a survey of 1,000 old people, people in their 80s, their 90s, like really old. And one of the questions he asked them, everything is old, as I get older, so people are a little bit older. So what he asked them was, and some of them were married multiple times, many of them had marriages for quite a long period of time, so they know what works and what doesn't work. And he has an incredible chapter in the book, this gerontologist, about what matters in marriage. Like, in your long life, how do you answer the question you just asked? What matters? And I'll give you the answers, but also the parts that are informed by other research. So number one is you want to marry somebody who is going to be your best friend. You know, meaning, now, it doesn't mean they're always going to be your best friend, but somebody who you really enjoy being with. You want somebody who's going to bring out the best in you. If you're not yourself with that person, if you're always on guard and they don't bring out the best in you, I'd be a little nervous. You want somebody who sort of loves you in a way that it brings out the best. Monastery study. Listen to the monastery study, everybody, okay? Professor at Harvard takes 8 men in their 70s, maybe 80s, puts them in a monastery for 5 days, changes the monastery to look like the world looked when they were 40 years old. Okay? Her name is Ellen Langer, psychologist at Harvard. And then she has a comparison group that spends the next week in the monastery. But this group that's spending the week in the monastery, where they're told the following. They say, think about yourself as if you were 40 years old again. And they change the monastery. Black and white televisions, the old kind of decor, the way the world looked when these men were 40. If they had to take their suitcase upstairs and they're not strong enough to do it, they'd have to carry it up themselves, one shirt at a time. They literally inhabited a psychological space as if they were 40 years old, and they treated each other the same way, 5 days. After 5 days, they had independent raters rating the men in the two groups, not knowing who was in the group that was treated like they were much younger. Listen to what they find. Unbelievable. And this was replicated by BBC in a documentary, even stronger findings. First thing they find is that every single one of the men, the 8 men, was independently rated as looking younger than he looked 5 days earlier. 100% of the time. Then, here's where it gets weird, ophthalmologists give them an eye exam, and they see better. Their manual dexterity is better. They just become younger for a little while. They get stronger. And in something not published in the publication on this, a newspaper reporter at the time said that when the men were waiting for the bus to take them home, these are men in their 70s and 80s, they spontaneously break into a game of two-hand touch football. Okay? They became younger. You want to marry somebody, not somebody who believes you're younger. You want to marry somebody who believes in you. If somebody believes in you, it's going to bring out the best in you. There's something called self-expansion. You want them to be open to your input, and you want to be open to their input. You want to grow together. Marriage is a people-growing machine. It doesn't mean you're going to be clones, but you're going to grow through bouncing off each other in a way that there's that mutual love. So the old people said that in that gerontology book. The name of the book, the author is a guy named Pilmer, P-I-L-L-M-E-R. Then the other thing they found was, of course, you have to have a mutual attraction, but it's also the ability to let go of your anger. The ability to, doesn't mean, it's a myth to say that you have to go to sleep not angry at each other, but the ability to let go, the ability to not hold on to grudges. Those are some of the core things that are found, okay? So you want somebody who does that to you. You want somebody who you really enjoy being with and makes you feel good about yourself and vice versa. And somebody who could let go of their rage. Those are the things that matter over time. And the mutual giving, like this week's Torah reading. The Vayeha, that the love only comes after years of mutual giving. It only comes from that. And one last thing, and then I'll end the answer to this. The Hebrew word for marriage, nisuin, the Tiferes Yisrael, this rabbi guy in the early 1800s, had this phenomenal insight. The word nisuin, he says, has embedded in it two truths. The inevitable differences between men and women, because men and women are inherently different by definition. They either could be a masa. Masa is embedded in the word nisuin, a burden that weighs us down. Or, if you relate to it in a positive kind of way, you know what the Hebrew word masa means? It's a song. It's something uplifting. It's something transcendent that could bear us higher. When you see the inevitable differences, not as a sign of this guy's broken or this woman's broken, but you see it as a sign of growth and changes. And one last thought, okay, on this, because it's an important thought. It's one of the more important analogies I'll give, the elevator story, the elevator analogy. Imagine if you went downtown to the Empire State Building and you were on an elevator at 5 to 9 in the morning, tomorrow morning, and it's really crowded, and you're going to the 47th floor in the Empire State Building, and there's some guy invading your personal space, pushing against you like he wants to get off the elevator, and you're getting angrier and angrier at him, and you're going to give him the dirtiest look you have when he finally gets off. You know how it makes you feel better when you give somebody a dirty look when they're driving weird or whatever? So you're ready. He gets off, let's say, on the 38th floor, and you're ready with your dirtiest look. You're going to really give it to him. You know, for some reason it makes you feel better, and you turn back, and you see he's blind. What was smashing into you was his cane. He was trying to keep his balance on that crowded elevator. What does that realization do to your anger? Your righteous indignation turns to empathy. Instead of giving him a dirty look, you want to help him off the elevator. That's the managing expectations part of marriage. Of course you're going to fight. That's what people in a relationship do for a living. Of course you're going to. Men and women, remember what's that video? I'm sure you show, the one about it's not about the nail. You know that great video?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not about it. It's not about the nail, right? If you didn't see it, Google on for the YouTube, it's not about the nail. It'll show this in a very powerful way. But the bottom line is that to the extent that you could transform the burden into the song, it's partly by seeing the inevitable tension in a relationship as part of what marriage is about, and then you grow through the mutual kind of engagement. Do you want me to tell a concluding story?
Please.
Okay. Here's a concluding story, because otherwise I'm going to have this story stuck in my throat.
There's one more question on
one
Facebook.
One more. We have to be... We're giving preferential treatment to the YouTube people, which is good. That's good.
But you can tell your story, and then we'll... Can I clarify the question, because it might change your story? When my question is not later... my question is later, what matters in marriage? But the last part, the dependence of the question, is the most important. When your attraction to somebody is dampened by, the ways that you don't connect
I'm not like, we didn't get to marriage. We got to like date. Well, I don't know. You know, like, we really enjoy talking, but like, I have a stronger educational background. We're like, that's where the question is. How do you deal with that?
I hear what you're saying. So you're saying,
but it does matter. How do you, when it.
Yeah, I hear. That's a complicated question. I hear what you're saying, because it could be, you know, similarities in background is somewhat of a predictor. It doesn't have to be a predictor, but it does make things a little bit easier when you have a similar background.
Although it wasn't, I jotted down like 6 of the 7 things, yeah. And it doesn't seem to factor in as high up.
It doesn't have to be. And I know many successful relationships with people who have very, very different kinds of backgrounds. I think there, sometimes it's a matter of time. Sometimes it's a matter of making a decision on what you're going to focus on. Sometimes it's a matter of managing your expectations. You know, I think that I hear. In other words, like, you know, and then I've known relationships that started very weak, you know, and then they develop over time with the shared life. And I hear it's a complicated business. You know, and I understand it's a core topic for many of the people in this room. Is how do you transform that? Let's hear the YouTube question.
Okay, Facebook. Yeah. But like, how do
you get? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm old. Yeah.
How do you get over an ex who you love because you want to focus on the next person?
That's a good question.
Good question, okay. Okay.
And you repeat the question in case
you take it. Yeah, so the question
it's
is...
It's like they're coming from the heavens, these questions.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I hear. Tell me the truth. You're making all these questions up.
Right, Tara has it written down on the chart.
Yeah. Well, the question is, how do you get over an ex you loved? Because it really is hard. And the first, there's more wisdom in this room than I have about that. And I'm sure many people here could tell you what's worked for you. But I'll just start with the first answer that comes to my mind is that the Hebrew word ashrei, which is the highest level of happiness, is tied to the Hebrew word yishur, which is the word for licensing or to validate. Meaning, if you've loved somebody and been close to them for quite some time, when you break up with them, it's like a death. It's like mourning, because you're losing your future. You had an image in your head of a future of spending your life together with that man or woman, okay? And now you've lost that. It's literally You're mourning what in essence is the death of a relationship and the death of your future. Give yourself a break. That's going to be hard. And it's going to feel like you're run over by a truck. Okay? And it's going
to
feel...
That's a good note to end.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for coming.
It's been a wonderful evening. Thank you. And, thank you. Yeah. Let's do it. Okay. Let's go for it. Thank you. Good evening, everybody. Okay. Let me just say that. So the first thing I want to say is just to validate. I think that's fine. In terms of strategies, I know that, you know, I've been through it in my life going many, many years ago. You know, and I'm sure the people in this room know that the real antidote is when you really, there's no greater joy than finding somebody who's going to really you're going to reconnect to, and who's going to meet those needs, not as a replacement, but somebody unique, somebody who's going to, you know, somehow reconnect you. And the last thing, a sense of hope. Hope somehow creates optimism, and optimism creates a place where you're more likely to be positive with somebody, and you're more likely in turn to be fun with somebody. Now, I'm too far from this to be speaking in a very wise way. Can somebody, I know we don't want to take too much time, can we have one wise answer on this? Or it doesn't even have to be wise. Somebody who's been through this, who found something that really worked. Yeah, please.
Someone told me you don't get over it, you just move on.
Okay, I like that. I like it. And you don't go over it, you move on. Now, that doesn't have to be seen as depressing. It can be seen instead as sort of saying, you know, you don't. The loss is the loss, and part of life is about separation and loss. But then you have hope, the reconnection. It's a reconnection in a new key. Can I get Jewish with you for a minute, guys? And this is going back.
I thought we were Jewish all night.
Oh, I'm sorry. But you know, one of the ways of thinking, and I know we're out of the season, so this is a little bit illegal, Tekia Truatzkia. Remember the chauffeur?
Yeah.
Not too long ago? So the chauffeur, one of the more common combinations, is Tekia Truatzkia. Meaning, what do those words mean? And by the way, that's the way in olden days we would go in times of war. We would go from one camp to another. Tekia is the Hebrew word for setting stakes. It's the Hebrew word for basically feeling connected and attached to where you are. It's when you really put down your roots. Trua is inevitable times. That's the one that goes ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. It means it's a cry of alarm. It's the inevitable periods of life when you break up with somebody, you have a loss, there's a death, there's an illness. You thought that things were stable, you know, you were the 12th grader in high school who was the king of the heap, and now you're a freshman in college and they're putting you in the locker or whatever it might be. Okay? So tekias in life are always followed by truas, but the hope is that after every trua, there's a tekia, meaning a reconnection in a new key. That's what the breaking up stuff is about. The breaking up stuff is about tekia, trua, tekia. You put down your stakes, and that's life, but it's never for good. It's never for good. Okay? Then you have the trua. And that's part of life also, and you grow from it. You grow from it. And then there's the tekia in a new key. Quick vignette, or I shouldn't.
Please.
Well, here's the quick vignette.
Okay.
And that's coming from Facebook. Okay. So here's the vignette. I have a colleague who specializes in trauma in Israel. And she was working with a Hasidic community outside of Sderot, where there were constant rocket attacks until the war, right? You'd have how many seconds?
14 to 16 seconds.
14 to 16 seconds, right? So when you had a code, it's called a code red. Sevadom, right? So here's what was happening. They were living in the Shkuna, right near where the rockets were coming from. And this little six-year-old boy, anytime there was a Sevadom, anytime there was a code red, he would run all over the place. So his mother would be running after him. Her life was in danger. His life was in danger. Rockets are falling. And he'd go into fight or flight. And my friend, the therapist, who's very effective, couldn't help. The mother figured it out. Listen to what she says to him. She says, you know, on Rosh Hashanah or that time of year, when there's a, when we hear the shofar, here's the symbol of the shofar. Symbol of the shofar is, okay, two things. One is the call of the shofar is saying, wake up, wake up, you have to act. And he was, ooh, you shame me, she asked him, get up, get out of your sleep, you have to act, you have to act. But the second message of the shofar is Imo Anochi Bitzara, Hebrew for, you're never alone, I'm with you, I'm here, I'm watching you. And somehow it hit him, the message of wake up and you're not alone, we're never alone, there's always hope. And from that moment on, anytime there was a Sevadom, a big smile would come off this little six-year-old boy's face, he'd give his mother his hand, and he'd calmly walk down to the shelter within that amount of time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you. Let's give it up. Thank Dr. Pelton.
Thank you.
I want to thank Dr. Pelton for his amazing presentation. He'll stick around for a few minutes for you to get a chance to ask a question. There's some more refreshments, beverages on the side, and I also want to just mention we will be continuing every single Monday night with these great classes and interviews. Tonight was very, very special. Thank you very, very much for being here.
So I invite you.
I give a class fall under one only Robert Mark Wilde. Also, we have an amazing ski trip, MJE. When is it, Tara?
February 9th.
February
9th. And we have a Hanukkah happy hour on February 15th. December.
And also, if you're not sure of the matzo ball thing, Christmas Day, we're having classes. Robert Wilde's giving class at 10 o'clock. I'm giving class at 11 o'clock. Starbucks and pastries are on us.
It's beautiful. Amazing.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy yours very much.
I'll talk about it.
Yeah, that was amazing. Thank you. I didn't tell my last story. Next time.
Thanks for a great discussion.
Also from Great
Also from Great Neck. What's your name?
Noah Oringer. Did you go to Great Neck Synagogue?
I go to the Young Israel.
Oh, you go to Young Israel. I need to start going to Young Israel. I know it's a really good path. I was there on Simchas Torah. Were you there?
This is Torah.
When I did graduate.
I'm going to close this.